in chapter 17. Say it again. Okay. All right. How's this depicted in the 17th chapter? Okay. John saw this great harlot, this woman who's a prostitute, sitting astride this great, terrible looking beast that John also describes, and we, of course, talked about the depiction of her in chapter 17. We talked about that on Sunday morning. Talked about some of the details of the beast that she is riding on. At the very end of the chapter, in verse 18, the angel is explaining things to John, and what does he say this woman is? All right. He says, she is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. According to chapter 17, what was eventually going to happen to her? Okay, she's doomed. He describes some of the horns of the beast turning on her, essentially, and humiliating and devouring her. We talked about some of the symbolism that is involved here, and if our approach to this book thus far has been correct, what John is emphasizing is that the power that was persecuting those Christians to whom Revelation was written was going to be brought down. Well, the power that there are lots of avenues through which they might be persecuted, but the thing that Revelation seems to be most concerned with is they're being persecuted because of their refusal to, for example, honor the Roman emperor as a deity. We talked a little bit about that. We talked about the beast and the false prophet that were introduced to us in earlier chapters as really being kind of two facets of that. For lack of a better term, I guess, the political face of Rome in terms of as represented by the emperors, the religious face of Rome, especially the cult of emperor worship. And we see some of those same things. What we talked about on Sunday was that chapters 17 and 18 in many ways present the same idea using different symbolism. What the woman and the beast represented are going to be conveyed to us again in the picture, this time in Revelation 18, of this great city. John has talked a lot. The name of Babylon keeps coming up in Revelation as a substitute for whatever it is that is standing against God's people and His purposes. Let's remind ourselves, why is Babylon a fitting representation of that? And in this case, of the Roman persecution against the Christians in the first century. Why is Babylon a suitable picture of that? Mark? Sure.
And Babylon as the world power of its time seems to correspond to Rome as the world the power of this time.
Okay, all right. And I'm glad Mark started off with that point, because that's something we're gonna spend a little time emphasizing tonight. In case you didn't hear what Mark said, I'll start with the second point first, and that is that what Babylon was in the Old Testament, in many ways Rome is in the New Testament in terms of being this world power, the seat of an empire that exercised control over vast territory and vast numbers of people, and was hostile to God, hostile to God's people. Of course, Babylon was the nation that ultimately took the people of Judah into captivity. That was by God's design. It was a punishment against them. But Babylon's hostility to God's people not only was an instrument that God used in that, but it later on became the cause for Babylon's own downfall. A lot of the prophetic language of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and other prophets, we're going to be looking at some of that tonight, focuses on the downfall of Babylon in the Old Testament. sometimes years before the event. Well, that's what Revelation is doing for the world power that was the immediate concern of these Christians at the end of the first century, the Roman Empire. Not that everything about Babylon is exactly the same as Rome, but then just the general idea there. And again, Mark said that a lot of the prophetic language that is used in those Old Testament passages is echoed, sometimes verbatim, in Revelation. You see a lot of that in this chapter. So we're going to spend a little time looking at that. We've seen this in the past in Revelation, a lot of heavy borrowing from Old Testament prophetic literature and other places in the Old Testament as well, but especially the prophets. I thought tonight would be a really good example of that as we go through, especially these first eight verses in Revelation chapter 18. You're going to see a lot of echoes from and quotations from Old Testament prophetic passages, a lot of which were about literal Old Testament Babylon. Some of them were about other nations that that had exalted themselves, like the city-state of Tyre or Edom or some others. We'll talk about that as we go along. So after these things, John writes, "I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And this angel cried out with a mighty voice," and what did he say? Okay. Does that sound familiar? Have we heard that before? Okay, thank you. I'm glad somebody said yes. Okay, yeah, we have. We've heard that before in chapter 14 and verse 8. One of the eagles that was an eagle that was flying was crying out, "Fallen is Babylon." One of the angels, not the eagle. Chapter 14 and verse 8. An angel was crying out, "Fallen is Babylon the great, she who made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." You have essentially the same language here. It's just amplified a bit. Let's look and see where some of these verses draw from. Fallen is Babylon the Great. Revelation 14 and verse 8. In Isaiah 21 and verse 9, that's exactly the language that Isaiah used in prophesying the fall of literal Old Testament Babylon. And remember that Isaiah is doing that several decades before Babylon actually fell. Roughly 150 years before the Babylonian captivity, and even more than that, before even more years leading up to the fall of Babylon. But Isaiah, as the prophets often do, is speaking of it with such surety that he can speak of it as if it's already happened, even though it's in the future. We saw Revelation do that in Revelation 14 and verse 8, and you see it again here. Fallen is Babylon the Great. And the second part of verse 2, what does this angel say she has become? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I love that. Dwelling place for demons and unclean spirits and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Well, that's similar to language that you find in Isaiah chapter 13. We're gonna go look at a couple of these. Turn over to Isaiah 13. Here is Isaiah prophesying about the ancient city of Babylon and the kingdom that surrounded it. And in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 19, says, "Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged." And you should note that there is similar language to that in Isaiah 34 when Isaiah is prophesying the downfall of the nation of Edom. And even Zephaniah uses similar language in chapter 2, prophesying the downfall of the Assyrian capital of Nineveh. This idea that this once proud and beautiful, prosperous and active city becomes a desolation. It becomes empty and not fit for the habitation of anything but birds and, in John's case, demons and unclean spirits and foul kinds of birds. A common illustration of destruction and desolation. Question. Did the city of Rome ever literally become what verse 2 describes? If you go to Italy now, is there a city of Rome still there? Yeah, okay. Some of you have been there, okay. So be careful when applying the language too literally in any of these cases, but particularly to Rome. But it's a picture of devastation. It's a picture that what now exists in John's day will not always be. Is Rome the seat of a massive empire that's, controlling the world and persecuting Christians now? No. Hasn't been for millennia. John's concern is not just the city of Rome itself, not even just the Roman Empire itself, but what that represents, this world power that is hostile to the people of God. She has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality. Well, we saw that in chapter 14 and verse 8 as well. Fallen is Babylon the Great, this is what she has done. When it talks, and again, let's remind ourselves of this, when he says she has made the nations drink of the wine of the passion or of the wrath of her immorality, what's the picture there? What does that mean she's done? Mark?
It's rejection
of God and faithlessness, or I think the immorality is a figure of, like the Old Testament figure of Israel's turning against God. Okay. All right. That idea of drinking a cup, of sharing in something. In this case, it's language that, again, is borrowed straight out of Jeremiah's prophecy against literal Babylon, Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 7. He says, uses almost exactly the same wording of Old Testament Babylon. She's made the kings of the earth or the nations drink of the cup of her immorality. Such a fitting picture. And of course, back in chapter 14 of Revelation, the picture was Babylon has made the nations drink of her immorality. Now she's going to drink of the cup of the wrath of God. Well, here's Babylon getting ready to do that. Chapter 18 is describing her downfall. The angel goes on to say, chapter 18 and verse 3, the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. We saw that chapter 17 and verse 2 applied to the great harlot, in very much the same language. And also, the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. That last expression in verse 3 is important because that's the thing that this chapter is going to emphasize. Chapter 17, in the picture of the harlot, emphasized the ungodliness, the immorality, the overt wickedness of this oppressing force against the people of God. Chapter 18 emphasizes something different. Chapter 18 emphasizes its wealth and its power and its luxury. Watch for that, because this chapter is just full of that picture. Really, little to nothing is said in chapter 18 about, in any explicit terms, about paganism or about emperor worship or any of that kind of stuff. What's emphasized in chapter 18 is wealth, luxury, self-satisfaction, exalting of oneself, and particularly exalting of oneself against God. Verse 4, John says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, Oh, I skipped over one. Hold on before I get to that. When he talks about the merchants of the earth being rich, made rich by the wealth of her sensuality, I couldn't find a specific comparison, a parallel in the language about Babylon in the Old Testament. But you do find something very similar in Ezekiel 27, actually chapters, I think, 26 through 28 of Ezekiel, are all about the city-state of Tyre, which was this is a Phoenician city that was a hub of trade and the exchange of wealth. And there's a lot of similar language in Ezekiel 27 especially, that calls to mind what John has just written here about Babylon of his own day. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues, in verse 4. What is God calling on his people to do here in verse 4? Okay. Is John saying that the Christians need to physically relocate to somewhere else? Is that the intent of our verse here? Okay. Okay. All right. Mike's suggestion is that this is a call for them to clearly mark themselves out by their conduct as belonging to God. Haven't we seen that imagery throughout Revelation? Everybody in Revelation is one of two things. They either belong to the beast or they belong to God. They've either got the mark of the beast or they're sealed by God on their foreheads. It's one or the other. There's a clear distinction between those who are followers of the Lamb and those who are worshipers of the beast. And this verse is a reminder to the Christians they need to separate themselves. And again, I think the idea is in their conduct. Because really, it would have been very hard for these people to go somewhere that wasn't under the control of the Roman Empire. It was possible. Okay, there were parts of the world that weren't, but that's really not the focus. Remember, this is symbolic, figurative language. But it is borrowed from passages like Jeremiah chapter 51, which are calling on people not to, where Jeremiah is calling on the people of his own day not to get too comfortable in Babylon, because they're going to want to come home. They're going to want to get out of Babylon because Babylon is going to be judged. Jeremiah is very specific, as Isaiah is, about the fact that God was going to use a foreign power to bring Babylon to judgment. And so he's calling on his people, you need to separate yourselves from them so that you don't become partakers in this judgment. In a similar way, that's what Revelation chapter 18 and verse 4 is saying to the people of God. Make sure that you separate, that you distinguish yourself from the world so that you don't partake in this judgment. Go ahead. Yeah, James mentioned Paul in 2 Corinthians 6, I think going on into the first part of chapter 7, where Paul's calling on us to separate ourselves from the world. John does that in 1 John chapter 2, 15 to 17, lots of places in the New Testament. You have just a very picturesque way of expressing it that draws on Old Testament language about Old Testament Babylon to do that. Verse 5, why is it that God says he wants his people to come out? Why is it, what is it about Babylon that has caused this judgment to be coming, according to verse 5? Okay. All right. He says, her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. I mentioned Jeremiah 51. Turn to Jeremiah 51, if you would. There are a lot of parallels from chapters 50 and 51 of Jeremiah that show up in Revelation chapter 18. Jeremiah 51, verse 9, we applied healing to Babylon, but she was not healed. Forsake her and let us each go to his own country. See, there's that idea of come out of her. For her judgment has reached to heaven and towers up to the very skies. So the picture is of this nation, this empire, that has piled up this pile of wickedness. Okay, it's a figurative description. Just imagine if you could literally stack wicked deeds up, then Babylon here in Revelation 18 has stacked up a pile that reaches up to the sky, just like Babylon of the Old Testament did. Even I ran across a phrase in the book of Ezra, I think it's in chapter 9, where Ezra is confessing the sins of the people who had returned from captivity, intermarriage with Gentiles, and he makes essentially the same statement: we've piled up our sins as high as heaven. It's a very poetic, picturesque way of describing the extent of, in this case, Rome's guilt. It's wickedness. That's why, he says, come out of her. That's why this judgment is coming. Her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back, even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. Literally, it says something like, double unto her double according to her deeds. In every way possible in this verse, in verse 6 and verse 7, the idea is that God's judgment is going to give Babylon every last drop of what she has brought on herself, every bit of what she deserves in terms of judgment and condemnation. Lots of Old Testament passages convey the same idea. Let's go back to Jeremiah and we'll just content ourselves to read there. We won't look at all these other ones. Jeremiah 50, verse 15. And again, this is Jeremiah talking about Old Testament Babylon. Jeremiah 50, verse 15, raise your battle cry against her on every side. She has given herself up. Her pillars have fallen. Her walls have been torn down. For this is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance on her as she has done to others, so do to her. And then again in verse 29, summon many against Babylon, all those who bend the bow and camp on her, against her on every side. Let there be no escape. Repay her according to her work, according to all that she has done, so do to her. For she has become arrogant against the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. You see similar language in even in Psalm 137 and verse 8. That's one of those imprecatory psalms. In fact, Psalm 137 is the one that's got some really violent language in it. Well, the psalmist is calling on God to repay Babylon according to her wickedness. And it's very similar language to what you see in Revelation 18. And you see also in Ezekiel 28 something similar to that with regard to Tyre. And my point in a lot of this is that Revelation 18 is just borrowing a motif from the Old Testament prophets that's very common in these things. It talks about this city or this empire piling up its sins before God, how it is pridefully exalted itself against God, and so now she's going to get what she deserves. God is going to bring justice on her. He's going to make her desolate, and in all these ways we've seen, in some cases, again, verbatim quotations from these Old Testament prophets. For example, this one. She says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow, and I will never see mourning. That is, a rather selective quote, but it's words from Isaiah chapter 47, verses 7 and 8. Anybody want to take a guess who Isaiah was talking about in chapter 47? You're right. Okay? He was talking about Old Testament Babylon. She had said exactly these same kinds of things. It's not just the wickedness that's the problem. It's her vaunting herself and exalting herself with such pride that she thinks she cannot be brought low and that she does not need God. She does not need to honor or fear Him. That was the guilt of Old Testament Babylon. That's the guilt of Rome and Revelation. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. The very next verse in Isaiah 47 contains language like that, talking about Old Testament Babylon. Jeremiah 50, you see, you know, where a lot of these images come from. She will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. Again, chapter 8, verse 8, you know, the plagues and the pestilence and the mourning and the famine, her being consumed with fire. Don't feel the need to take all of that with wooden literalism. Okay, Rome's not consumed with a fire. Okay, when Revelation's written, the great fire we read about, that, you know, the one that Nero was suspected, that already happened. And you don't have some great consuming fire that brings an end to the city of Rome. That's not the point. The point is God's judgment. These pictures of desolation, famine, pestilence, plagues, mourning, fire, all the things that people dreaded in the ancient world that could put an end to an entire society. Revelation chapter 18 talks about them falling on Babylon. And that's, you know, just a sampling of some of the Old Testament prophetic language that is borrowed here. That is all through the book of Revelation, but I just thought this was a good place to stop and reflect on how densely packed it is with language from Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and the Psalms and some of the other Old Testament prophets. Now, in the rest of the chapter, in verses 9 through 24, especially let's think about verses 9 through 20. You've got, this is question number 5 on your lesson. You've got several different groups of people who are pictured as mourning when they see the destruction. They're weeping and crying. They're devastated by the destruction of this great city of Babylon. For instance, in chapter 18, in verses 9 and 10, who is said to be weeping at Babylon's overthrow? All right? The kings of the earth. Those same kings of the earth who had committed immorality with her and lived sensuously with her. Well, why are they weeping and mourning over her destruction? They're not going to get to do that anymore, sure. Okay. The source of their power and their fun has been brought down. They're standing at a distance, verse 10, because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." If we get a chance, we'll come back and talk about that idea of one day and 1 hour in a minute. Beginning in verse 11, and this is the longest stretch here. Who is weeping over the fall of Babylon starting in the 11th verse? All right, merchants. Why are they upset? Okay. Yeah. All the commodities and avenues of trade and sources of income and prosperity for them are gone. And these verses go into a lot of detail describing all the different aspects of wealth that flowed in and out of this great city, Babylon, and enriched merchants and tradesmen in the process. And we won't, you know, take time to read all those. You can read them for yourself. Hopefully you did before our class tonight. It was just an extensive, detailed description of all this, all the wealth of trade that is taken away. How about beginning in the second part of verse 17. Who's mourning and weeping for the destruction of Babylon? Okay. Okay. Shipmasters and sailors and passengers on. Why? And why has this come into the picture? Okay. Okay, all right. We saw in chapter 17, the harlot sat upon many waters. That's also lifted from Old Testament language applied to Old Testament Babylon, sitting on many waters. And we talked about one aspect of that symbolism, water, you know, seafaring trade and riverfaring trade. That's how goods got moved in large bulk, quickly and effectively in the ancient world. literal shipping. Well, the merchants are all upset. The merchants of the earth, in verse 11, they're devastated by the downfall of Babylon. And all the sailors and shipmasters and those who make their living by the sea, those who facilitate all this trade, they're also weeping and mourning for the overthrow, because that means the end of their livelihood. They were crying out as they saw, verse 18, the smoke of her burning, saying, "What city is like the great city?" And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out and weeping and mourning, and they're all just, you know, lamenting this great city that has been laid waste. Because as long as it was prospering, they prospered. The kings of the earth, the merchants, the sailors, their position, their livelihood, their comfort, their wealth, all depended on Babylon. And now, chapter 18, that's all gone. So in verse 21, I'm sorry, verse 20, who is called on, everybody's weeping and mourning and moaning and groaning, who is called on to rejoice in verse 20? All right. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets. Why should they be rejoicing at this downfall? Okay. Going all the way back to chapter 6, you think about the martyred souls underneath the altar. What were they crying out for? Yeah, they were crying out, "How long, O Lord? How long is it going to be until you avenge us?" You know, John is seeing in this vision the dead souls, the souls of the dead who had been killed for the cause of Christ, and they're crying out for God to do justice, to avenge them, to punish those who have done this to them. And it was told that they were going to have to wait just a little bit longer. Now here in Revelation chapter 18, that judgment is coming. And all the saints and apostles and prophets are called on to rejoice because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. And then to really put an exclamation point on the whole thing. In verse 21, a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer." In Jeremiah chapter 51, Jeremiah gave instruction to the scribe Sariah to take a scroll containing these judgments against Babylon that Jeremiah had been given by God, to take it to the city of Babylon and read this litany of warnings contained in the scroll, and then tie a stone to the scroll and throw it into the river Euphrates. And the fact that it was going to sink and not rise again was a token of the permanent destruction that was coming on Babylon. You have a very similar image right here in this angel that takes this stone, this great stone like a mill, this is a humongous stone, in other words, and throws it into the sea and says, "So will Babylon be overthrown and she will not be found any longer." And in verse 22 and 23, what are some of the things this angel lists that are not going to be found in Babylon anymore? All right. So, you know, all kinds of musical sounds, they're not going to be found. What else? Okay. No sounds of any craftsmen of any craft or the sound of a mill. How about verse 23? All right. The light of the lamp. Yeah. None of the sounds of the festivities of a wedding, the bridegroom and bride, because it's all been brought down. This is also very common Old Testament prophet language that is used. Sometimes it was used against Jerusalem, warning her that she needed to repent of the devastation that might come her way, as well as some of the pagan nations. But it is, again, it is a description of of the removal of everything that is an indicator of joy and commercial activity, you know, all the hustle and bustle and the common noises that you would hear in a city, and the noises of music and the noises of celebration of weddings. It's gone. It's an image of total desolation and desertion. Verse 24, what was found in her? What's the, you know, the reason for all of this? Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that idea keeps coming back up. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. And I think the focus of the all who have been slain is those who have been martyred for Christ. She's responsible for all of that. She had the power to initiate persecution. She had the power to withhold persecution. And she chose to persecute God's people. One of the chief messages of Revelation is you don't do that and get away with it. You do not attack the people of God and get away with it. Babylon, Rome, has not. And not again, it is not just the city of Rome that John is concerned with, not even just the Roman Empire that he is concerned with. That's what he is most immediately concerned with. But Rome in Revelation is in a way representative of the world in its opposition to God and His purposes and His people. So there are applications in every generation when God's people are undergoing persecution. And that brings us to a conclusion for tonight. We will talk about chapter 19, which is the flip side of chapter 18. There's mourning and weeping over the devastation of Babylon in chapter 18. There is rejoicing among the people of God in chapter 19. And we'll talk about that Sunday morning. Any questions or comments before we finish up tonight? All right. Well, thank you for your participation this evening. Hope we were challenged a little bit. Hope we learned something.